What's interesting here on that, I think I don't know what the solution is, but my hunch tells me that some company out there will determine how to rebrand itself as a sustainable packaging name. And just like Tesla's market capitalization has increased rapidly over its peers, Ford and GM and all the other auto manufacturers, once there's a brand identification as that company is sustainable plastics, I could see their market cap jump also, simply on reputation alone.
That was right from the middle of this week's episode. So, can a company brand itself as sustainable plastic and create an impact like Tesla? To find out all about the plastics industry, its value chain, and the big companies involved in it, stay tuned for the full conversation. Hello and a warm welcome to this episode of Mission Chunya. Hope you are doing well. Good to have you back on this episode. And in case if this happens to be the first time you're listening to this podcast, a special welcome to you. Mission Chunya now has well over 50 episodes, and if you see the playlist, you can see the range of topics I cover. It's all centered around sustainability and getting to net zero emissions. And today's topic is no different. We all use plastics in our lives, but apart from the general awareness about the need to recycle, what else do we know about it? What about the plastic industry, the value chain? And what about the industry stakeholders? And what are they doing to undergo sustainability transformation? Maybe we don't know much. It's an interesting and a relevant topic. So, I managed to get in touch with an expert, as always. So, the expert for this week is...
Hello, my name is Gabriel Toomey. I'm the head of plastics program and director of financial markets at Planet Tracker.
So, Gabriel, let's begin by looking at the origin story of Planet Tracker. How did Planet Tracker come about, and what is the key difference that Planet Tracker aims to do?
Planet Tracker is the second of three organizations that have been spun out of Investor Watch.
Okay.
Investor Watch is a collaboration that was started by Mark Campanelli and Nick Robbins during the climate conference in Copenhagen in 2009. They had observed the conversation that was ongoing, not much happened at the conference. And so they started the first organization, Carbon Tracker.
Okay.
Then they started the second organization, Planet Tracker, 3 years ago. And this last month, they announced the beginnings of the third organization, Industry Tracker. Planet Tracker's purpose is to provide the information and data so capital markets can align themselves and institutions in capital markets can align themselves directly with planetary boundaries. These are boundaries around biodiversity, geochemical flows, water quality and quantity, land use change, ocean acidification, and other boundaries. It's from these boundaries that the natural capital foundation is created by which we live upon. So when oceans are too acidic, for example, corals die. When corals die, there's no nursery for fish, more or less speaking. If there's no nurseries for fish, there are nurseries for fish elsewhere too, so I understand that. But this is an illustration only. There's no nurseries for fish. We have less fish in the sea and less fish we may eat. So it's that sequencing set of ecological parameters that Planet Tracker is working to align capital markets within.
That's very good. Good to know about what Planet Tracker is all about and what are its main intentions. And you do mention about planetary boundaries. And your key focus in this space in Planet Tracker is to look at the plastic industry and help kind of understanding how plastic industries can have a sustainable transition. What is the single biggest impact do you think a sustainable transition of the plastic industry can have on the planet?
So I think a couple things. One is the industry needs to step up from changing a single production line or changing a single facility to realize the industry functions in clusters, which insiders inside the industry understand this. But outsiders, like you and me, we may not often go visit chemical industrial parks, right?
Exactly.
But if one, right, that's the issue. So if one visits a chemical industrial park, one will see all the pipes going from one facility to another, to another, to another. And there may be brands or names on the pipes or the facilities themselves. All this production is connected.
Okay.
A company may sell ethylene to another company that then becomes ethylene oxide. And that company may sell DMT that gets used in PET production or ABS production. So this is how we need to understand it's a production process. That's the first thing that plastics is. Well, we understand it as a product. Chemical engineers see it as a production process. And that process is clustered. And there are key clusters around the world, maybe 20 or 30 clusters around the world that are very important from a single-use plastics perspective.
Okay.
Once we understand that, we have a boundary condition around production. Then we need to have a boundary condition around use.
Okay.
What does that mean, right? We have something called deposit return schemes or extended producer responsibility. And there are many other options too. Well, think of this classic case in the United States. There are 91,000 municipalities and cities and counties.
Okay.
And each has its own recycling policy.
Wow.
Yeah. So you have 332 million people, including children, right? They can dump their trash in the rubbish bin. Some places it's green, some places it's blue, and some places there's no plastic recycling. Each county has its own policy, and that has to roll all the way back up through reverse logistics to a large corporation like Veolia, who works in waste management. So they need to pivot their model from a waste as a liability to waste as an asset. That's the second thing. Now, but in between, you have corporations who produce plastic and then sell us plastic wrapped around their wrapper that's often wrapped around food. So that's plastics containers and packaging companies like Uflex and Jindal and Amcor and Berry Global, companies no one's ever heard of. But we know the companies that we buy the food from. It can be Nestle and a Walmart. Those companies, what they want is standardized packaging and consistent application of policy in all jurisdictions they work in. So Nestle works in 187 countries. They would like to have standardized deposit return schemes. So it's a competitive market, and one can have the same product they can sell in all markets. And so there's many different angles here to create that pathway to sustainability. And plastics are both, in summary, right, a product that comes out of a chemical engineering process. There's waste that occurs at that production level, which we'll talk about shortly, toxic chemicals that get released in the environment, GHG emissions, but there's also that those productions clustered. And then you have the issues around needing standardized product and standardized policy for the packaging companies and the fast moving consumer goods companies. Then you have reverse logistics on waste management.
That's interesting. And as you rightly say, the general consumers like you and me kind of look at plastics in isolation and think, it's just a single product, but you rightly pointed out that it is a clustered effort. There is a lot that goes into plastic. At this point, I also feel like reading through your reports, plastic is defined differently by different segments. You did mention about an example of Nestle and why they want to have standard definitions, standard policies across all the regions they operate. So even in common terms, plastic is defined even among different clusters in a different way. Can you give us some idea about how it is classified in general?
Yeah, that's a really important point. So plastic is like a product of a chemical engineering process. A parallel would be, say, plastic is food, right? In a grocery store or an hacienda or a local place might sell, one might sell rice, one might sell beans, but they both call it food. What happens is plastic is many different products. There are many different types of plastic. So the definition of what one means and one says the word plastic is very important. High density polyethylene is different than low density polyethylene. And it's different than linear low density polyethylene. And pretty soon we'll go down through the list. There are about 17 to 20 different plastic product families.
Wow.
So we have polyurethanes, we have polyesters, and polyesters can be both bottles, and polyesters can also be in textiles, like the polyester we wear. We have polypropylene that can also be used in packaging, but polypropylene is also a product that you can wear. It's a textile. We have ABS, which is a hard plastic. We have PVC polyvinyl chloride, which is often used in windows and in building and construction. So another way of thinking about plastic is one company that specializes in plastic container and packaging is Sealed Air. And Sealed Air sells over 200,000 products.
Wow.
And then within each product, there are plasticizers, there's coloring, there's mixture, sometimes there's wire, sometimes there's paper or cardboard, or there's clay on paper itself. Pretty soon it's a very complicated product. And then to put that into a recycling bin makes it very difficult to recycle. So for example, an easy solution is what is called in-molding of labels. If you think of a plastic bottle, instead of having the label wrapped around the bottle, and the label is in a different type of plastic?
I think it's mostly as a small logo on the surface. Is that the one?
Exactly. Well, you can do, there can be variations on that. That's an exciting technological solution to decreasing plastic waste in the ocean, is in labeling of labels.
That's interesting to know about in labeling of plastics. We also spoke about what Planet Tracker does. I think you also have a plastic tracker. So what is the objective of the plastic tracker?
So the work we do is we take a theme that investors, asset managers, corporations, sovereign wealth funds, policymakers, civil society, companies themselves, the general public has heard of: plastic.
Correct.
And my research team researches how do we describe that from a capital markets perspective. How do we slice and dice the 40,000 publicly traded companies to come up with the 83 companies in the plastic container and packaging universe, which is in the tracker, right? So how do we create a boundary condition so it's never going to be perfect, but it's good enough to enable research by others? It's good enough to enable corporations to change policy. It's good enough for investors to create policy themselves. So in the case of plastics containers and packaging, this is institutions that take the resins from ExxonMobil or Saudi Aramco, and they take those resins and they turn it into the packaging. They then sell to Unilever or to Heineken or to someone else, and we consume as the outside, generally, of a food product that's on the inside, or the outside of which inside it's a wrapping, right?
Correct.
First of all, no one had described this list of companies before.
True.
Okay. That helps us figure out how can we engage with them. But then how did we create that list of companies? We decided companies needed to have more than $100 million in revenue in the plastic container and packaging sector on an annual basis, and over 10% of their total revenue from the sector. From that, we come up with the 83 companies.
Okay.
That are equivalent to 93% of all overall publicly traded revenue in the sector. Then we can rank them and we can assess them. Now, that's really interesting too, Goresh, because we need to be able to do all of this in a replicable manner that you, your friends, our parents, our kids, right, could all repeat themselves. That's the value of research, is when it's replicable. And that's in particular what is most valuable about our research when we work with asset managers like BlackRock and Vanguard and others, some of the largest asset managers on earth, is that I can tell them, this is my methodology, they can repeat it, and I'll come up with the same list of names.
That's very interesting to know, and I think it definitely shows that it's an exhaustive list and it's a well-researched list. I think you cover the entire value chain, all the major players, like you said, and that's a pretty exhaustive list so that it gives every bit of the detail that gets into a final plastic product. Now, if you were to look at the list, you said you rank players in the list as well. So on top of your mind, what do you think the best companies in the list are doing? What are the best practices that they are doing? Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, I mean, the best practices is that at the executive and board of director level, they're creating policies by which they can drive the company's strategy. Given the amount of plastic waste that's entering the ocean, plastic waste that's entering the air, and into our terrestrial ecosystems. Now, why does that matter? It's because we are now seeing plastic waste, for example, in the bloodstream of children that are born. It comes to the umbilical cord. We don't necessarily know the impact that may have directly, but we do have seen corollaries where the impact, where individuals who live near plastic production sites, for example, have much higher cancer risk in the United States. In some cases, up to 50 times higher.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, it is. It doesn't mean that that's correlation, but it's co-location, right? So it's a risk and not an incident. Now, what this means is that we have to understand that these companies understand they need to transition their industry. So they need to have the first best practice is to have a whole of business approach to transitioning their company, not transition a single production line, not transition a single product. We think of Sealed Air and 200,000 products. They need to transition all their products, not just product 199,998, right?
So correct.
That is part of a corporate strategy for how will these, are they going to address these risks moving forward? They need to understand, they need to have a strong understanding of footprinting, their production, because it doesn't mean they can solve the footprinting, but they need to understand what the life cycle analysis and footprint is at the production, use, and waste management stages.
Correct.
They need to design their products for deconstruction and reuse, right?
True.
So can we have fewer plastics in a plastic bottle or fewer plastics, instead of having multi-layered wrapping, have single layer wrapping, so single layer, one single type of plastic, so it's easier to recycle that plastic product.
Correct.
Or fewer additives or the colors or the plasticizers are fewer, because that way we can, when we deconstruct the product, it's easier to reuse. Or are the plasticizers and additives and colorings less carcinogenic? There's many small pieces here of that puzzle. Now, what they haven't figured out how to do is brand this story. So there are companies around the world who are taking action. They haven't figured out how to brand themselves as part of the new plastics economy. No company has yet figured out how to brand themselves as a zero-waste plastic solutions provider.
That's interesting to know that you say that companies do have best practices, but the communication is not coming out in the right medium or in the right frame.
That's right. Yeah, and it's interesting. Sometimes it's simple, yet costs a lot of money. Many of the Japanese companies may have policies or often do have policies, but they're written in Japanese. To translate a sustainability report from Japanese to English is actually very, very expensive, in the nature of $200,000. Simply for the translator itself, before it goes to legal compliance in both the Japanese capital markets and in the English-speaking capital markets, primarily U.S.
Wow.
So there are barriers, right? The same thing we find with translating of data coming out of Mandarin-speaking and Cantonese-speaking regions of the world, you know, obviously Taiwan and China and Hong Kong. And so there's a translation issue. There's also issues on... they struggle to take responsibility for the product they produce. And it's not about them. It's about our society. For the last 80 years, over and over again, since the 1950s in the United States, we've been taught that litter is the responsibility of me as the litter bug, if you know that phrase. I'm the litter bug. I threw my litter out. Yes, of course. I don't want to throw the litter on the side of the road when I buy the product. Now, if the only chocolate I can buy is wrapped in plastic and I have no place to recycle that plastic, is that my problem? Or is that the problem of the company that produced the plastic? So they changed the model from being the trash is the responsibility of the producer to the litter being the responsibility of the consumer. So now, yes, I understand that's the issue. The conversation has further migrated to being the litter is the responsibility of the municipality, the community that must then fund waste management. Yet the product is being produced by some of the wealthiest companies in the world. Don't they have a responsibility here for the product they produce? That's called extended producer responsibility. And having a systemic approach that be across nations or in large markets such as India or in the United States around extended producer responsibility would significantly change the conversation around and motivate companies to embrace the new plastic economy.
extended producer responsibility is definitely catching up, as you rightly mentioned, in markets like India. And it's getting into multiple segments, right? From plastics is one thing, but even like hazardous chemicals and even, for example, batteries, everything is getting under extended producer responsibility so that the loop is closed technically. So that's a good practice that is coming along. Gabriel, you do write about it in a variety of reports because most of your work is well-researched, goes into the finer details of the industry, the value chain. So among your recent reports, the one that I kind of read and picked up was Unwrapping Investor Risk in the Global Plastic Container and Packaging Sector. What are your key findings from that report?
The key findings are 20 companies around the world are responsible for 64% of the revenue in the industry for the plastic containers and packaging sector.
Wow.
Now, I think this is the first time these 20 companies have ever been on a list themselves. Also, it's because the companies have very different market capitalizations.
Okay.
Amcor is about $20 billion. Viscofan, which is out of Spain, is about $3 billion.
Okay.
If you look at Uflex, they're out of India, they're about $400 million. So having a list of 20 companies that are global, different market caps, in different markets themselves is unique itself. What we found in the sector is that most companies are not reporting policies regarding plastic pollution, waste, biodiversity, water, and other tangential issues that are material to entering a new plastics economy. In fact, 53 companies had no policies on key sustainable packaging related topics. So most of the companies did not have any policies. That's when we searched using Bloomberg. They may have policies, remember, in other media channels. I reserve the right to be completely wrong on that. I hope I am, because I'd like them to have more policy. We found that the overall market capitalization of the industry is $126 billion. Yet, of all the fixed income securities we surveyed, at the time of the writing of the paper, there were zero green bonds and zero green loans or sustainability-linked loans in the industry.
That's a big surprise.
As this happens, literally 3 days after the final draft of the paper, Huhtamäki in Finland issued a sustainability-linked loan for 400 million euros to retool one of its production lines. So now that's Moore's law, how these things happen. You always get, no matter when you say, when you provide a zero, you always get a one or another surprise. We found that the top 20 institutional investors in the Planet Tracker plastic containers and packaging universe had unrealized gains of $8 billion. So these companies like BlackRock and Vanguard and other great companies we know have unrealized gains or unrealized profit, you can think of it more broadly, of $8 billion on their books. Should be the incentive. This is obviously an incentive for these large investors to have a policy to engage with these companies, to get these companies to embrace the new plastic economy to protect those gains.
That's definitely a huge number. And as you rightly said, these companies definitely have a responsibility to engage with these companies and ensure that they are in the right trajectory in the sustainable transition. You did mention about green bonds. What's your opinion on why is there a lack of uptake in green bonds? And do you think you did mention it's changing. Where do you see green bonds playing a role in this transition?
So I think what's happening is the companies are using working capital to refinance a production line.
Okay.
So they're still thinking on one production line at a time.
Okay.
And that would be too small from a green bond or green loan perspective. If we start thinking about how they want to reposition the firm, and let's say that means retooling its supply chain itself, the product design, so the products that are designed for sustainability, sustainable recycling, sustainable reuse, remanufacturing, and with much lower natural capital impacts, such as greenhouse gas emissions are decreased, lower water impacts, lower toxic chemical releases. I think that's a different approach. And that's where we start to see green bonds coming to the fore. Interestingly, in the industry, 70% of its fixed income securities are maturing in the next 5 years.
Interesting.
If I'm a banker, I see this as a huge opportunity to help these companies reposition they themselves inside their industry as green leaders by issuing green debt or sustainable link loans or green loans over the next 5 years as a to replace those securities that are coming due. But then what's the use of proceeds? Now, what's happened is most of the green bond conversation has not looked at manufacturing of plastics. This is globally, right? So there hasn't been much discussion on what's the appropriate use of proceeds to label something as green.
Correct.
On the other hand, if we understand that the feedstock for plastics is fossil fuel, over 99% of plastic is produced by hydrocarbons.
True.
Then we understand that if we look at plastic production from a feedstock perspective, green bonds can be easily applied to changing to alternate feedstocks or to changing to a closed loop system. What was once trash becomes an asset, and that asset then is fed back through the system through mechanical recycling or chemical recycling, or even best case circumstances, reuse and refill. So I think that it's a different approach to green financing. And it's a part of the supply chain that green financing has not looked at very much in the past. But I think it's a huge opportunity, and those numbers are going to grow, certainly. Now, not in the report, we go upstream one level from the plastic containers and packaging names to the resin producers.
Okay.
Of the 496 fixed income securities my research team has surveyed, 12 are green.
That's good.
Well, that's a much higher number. Now, that's led by Indorama, which is a PET plastic bottle manufacturer, one of the largest in the world, that's out of Thailand, and Lotte Chemical out of Korea, each with 3 or 4 green bonds and loans each. So those are examples of companies that are moving towards embracing sustainable plastic production, because that's one step upstream. I think they could be examples of what can be applied midstream, the plastic container and packaging level.
As I understand, options like green bonds can definitely be in the system, but at a different level in the value chain, right? Not at the manufacturing of plastic level, but a little upstream, or for example, on the other end at the source material, the hydrocarbons. So green bonds definitely can play a role there in kind of reworking on how the capital is financed in getting the raw materials for the plastic. Am I right?
Yes, that's correct. An example of green bond usage by a PC&P name could be retooling to incorporate alternate feedstocks.
Okay.
Such as, you know, sugarcane or paper and pulp, you know, lignin that comes out of as a paper and pulp product. It could be redesigning all their products for sustainable packaging. What's interesting here on that, I don't know what the solution is, but my hunch tells me that some company out there will determine how to rebrand itself as a sustainable packaging name. And just like Tesla's market capitalization has increased rapidly over its peers, you know, Ford and GM and all the other auto manufacturers, once there's a brand identification as that company is sustainable plastics, I can see their market cap jump also and their associated financial ratios simply on reputation alone.
That's definitely a wonderful recommendation. But adding to that, on a final note, I would like to ask, as an expert in this space, what are your other key recommendations for companies in this sector to kind of implement a sustainability transition, get a plan which they can probably act upon?
They need to have quarter by quarter commitments to 2025. The numbers they use in these commitments can be a range, because one cannot always forecast what's going to happen on a quarter by quarter basis. I completely understand that. We live and work in the real economy. But these commitments need to be made so that they can describe the directionality of where they're going. Now, we find a company like Amcor. Amcor is rapidly increasing its sustainable plastics production. And as it's doing that, its profitability is increasing. One just has to listen to the earnings call they had a couple months ago when they described this exact circumstance. So I think the companies need to stay ahead and embrace sustainability wholeheartedly from the executive and board directors down, and realize that those, if they want to be a successful company 10 to 15 years from now, they want to be part of the solution. They don't want to be part of the problem. And being part of the solution, we'll have a different set of investors. We'll open up to a much broader investor base, which can increase their market capitalization. There's a lot of follow-on positive feedbacks there. Ultimately, the need to embrace sustainability within all their processes of design, production, reuse, refill, and end of life, turning what is once waste into an asset. If they don't do that, other companies are already starting to step in. There are companies around the world now who are mining, literally, our trash dumps for plastic to recycle.
True.
So these companies need to step and stay ahead of the curve, embrace where the markets are going to be 10 to 15 years from now, and markets 10 to 15 years from now are going to be dominated by sustainable products. The plastic packaging we have of today will, in our lifetimes, dissipate and change, and will no longer be what we're used to seeing. And so these companies really need to embrace that change and see it as an opportunity set to grow strategically into new markets and with new product.
That was well said. It couldn't have been said better. Companies need to embrace the change and be ahead of the curve, because everything is changing at a rapid pace and sustainability is one key thing that's holding everything together. And if these companies have to stay relevant, then they have to adapt and evolve with the transition. So, Gabriel, it was a very insightful conversation. And for someone who's listening to this podcast right through, kind of will understand that we haven't gone in depth about plastics. We all know that plastics is a challenge. It's a challenge to the environment and we all need to act on it. But never really we got a chance to look at the value chain and understand what's the problem, what are companies doing, and where are the gaps, and how are companies transitioning by adopting a sustainable plan, sustainability transition plan. So it was an insightful one. Thanks for taking time to join me on the podcast today.
Thank you very much, Goresh. It's a real honor to be here today and to be here to help your listeners understand a complex topic, be able to, so they themselves can understand what action they may be able to take. Thank you very much.
That was a wrap on the conversation with Gabriel. Hope you found some insights in the conversation. Talking of plastics, it is very scary to note that evidence actually points out that plastics is getting into the system in newborns and also causes cancer, etc. One other takeaway from Gabriel's research is that companies don't seem to know how to brand their sustainability transformation, like getting to zero waste process, etc. Hopefully, they can start getting better in their communication strategies. So, as an action item for this week, let's take a minute to check where our responsibility lies in handling plastic. If we bought an item that has plastics, let's take responsibility to send it to the right recycling unit. Irresponsible discarding should never be undertaken. If you would like to know more about Planet Tracker or connect with Gabriel, the easy way is on LinkedIn or via email. Both the details are in the description of this podcast and also on the website missionjunia.com. At this point, I should also thank Brian from Carbon Fund, who was earlier on the podcast, for introducing me to Gabriel and setting up this conversation. Finally, if you like the episode, do subscribe and give it a rating and review on Apple Podcast or any audio or social media platform that you use. It definitely helps in getting the message to a wider audience. With that, this is Girish Shivakumar signing off, and as always, thank you for listening.